much. I'd like to thank the organizers for being here. So I will indeed talk about gravitational duality. Well, electric magnetic duality is a symmetry which is well known in the context of ordinary Maxwell theory. It plays also a very important role in extended supergravities, where there are many abelian vector fields, and the symmetry is enlarged and is used as in order to understand better the properties of the theory. And in fact, and this is a point I will stress very strongly in the talk, I mentioned it already now, duality, already electric magnetic duality in the context, in the simple context of Maxwell, is more than just a symmetry of the equations of motion, it's also a symmetry of the action, as I will show, but this will not be the main point of my talk. The main point of my talk will be directed to understanding better, or to explain and understand the analog of electric magnetic duality for electromagnetism, so which exchange the electric field with the magnetic field in the context of gravity. We can also define an electric component to the Riemann tensor, a magnetic component to the Riemann tensor, and the equations of motion are invariant under rotations of these two, in the planes of these two tensors. And it is a symmetry which has attracted a lot of interest recently because it's supposed to be an important element in understanding the problem of hidden symmetries. Now, what is the problem of hidden symmetries? Well, it has been conjectured, well, let me put the entire slice. It has been conjectured some time ago that M-theory, or appropriate extension of M-theory, maximal supergravity, or appropriate extension of maximal supergravity, which would be, for instance, M-theory, might have a huge infinite dimensional symmetries, which is controlled by a Kac-Moody algebra, could be E10 or E11. So I drew the Dynkin diagrams of E10 and E11. I realized that I changed the way the nodes were numbered. I mean, I took different conventions, but I mean, you can see the diagrams nevertheless. And it turns out that these symmetries, which are huge, contain, in particular, the electric magnetic duality in the gravitational sector. And for that reason, if we want to make progress in that conjecture, we should understand better gravitational duality. One crucial feature of these algebras is that all fields are treated and the dual are put on the same footing. For instance, whenever you have a P-form gauge field which is predicted to exist from that algebra, so what people typically do, you have this algebra, you look at your adjoint representation, you decompose your adjoint representation under appropriate space-time group, and then you will find space-time tensors, you will find particular P-forms. But you see that whenever there is a P-form, automatically the dual D minus P minus 2 form appears. And similarly, the graviton does appear in the spectrum predicted by the adjoint representation, but also appears the dual graviton. Well, again, this I will explain later. I'm just trying to give you here some motivation, which are not yet precise, but they will be made precise later on. The dual graviton, which is a strange object described by a tensor with a mixed Young symmetry type, also appears. And so, as I said, if we want to understand better these algebras, we should better understand gravitational duality. Now, in the rest of my talk, I will actually not talk about this algebra, so I will not go into the high level of infinite dimensional, hyperbolic, or Lorentzian Kac-Moody algebra. I will stick to rather elementary things, which are trying to understand or describe first and try to understand gravitational duality. So it doesn't matter. I mean, you can follow the talk even if you don't know what E10 or E11 is. Okay. I will first start with things which are extremely well known, namely the standard electric magnetic duality used by Dirac, for instance, but I think it was known a long time ago, probably by Helmholtz and the fathers of electromagnetism, in the original D equal 4 context. But one point that I will stress, because I think it has relevance for E10, is that this symmetry is not just a symmetry of the equations of motion, but it's also a symmetry of the action. It's a bit paradoxical at first sight, but I will explain why it is indeed so. I will then move on to the analog, but for Einstein theory, but actually not the full Einstein theory, but only Einstein theory at the linearized level, so the polyphase theory. And then I will show how to go to higher dimensions, because after all, 11-dimensional supergravity or M theory are naturally described in 11 dimensions. And then I will conclude and talk about some open questions. So let me start with the Maxwell theory in four dimensions. It's something which is in all textbooks, that the Maxwell's equations are invariant under the following transformations of the fields. So if you rotate the electric field and the magnetic field, I mean, in the internal plane according to this, well, or in covariant form, that is equivalent. If you do that, well, the Maxwell's equations are clearly invariant because the Maxwell equations take a symmetric form between F and its dual, just dF equal to zero, or dF star is equal to zero, or in terms of electric magnetic field, there is a great symmetry between these equations. And if you do these rotations, indeed, you will find that you map a solution on a solution. This is a duality transformation. Okay, now what I claim, and I would like to substantiate the claim, is that these transformations also leave the Maxwell action invariant. Now, this is the Maxwell equation. You might say that what I am telling is completely nonsense, because E squared minus B squared is not something invariant under rotations. It's invariant under hyperbolic rotations, or Lorentz transformation in the EB plane, but not under rotation. So how can I claim that the action is invariant when it doesn't look that it is invariant? Also, by the way, it looks like it's invariant under hyperbolic rotations, but you can see that the equations of motion are not invariant under hyperbolic rotation. So there is some kind of a paradox that you have an action which has some invariance and that would have some invariance. I will see that there is no paradox. I will show that there is no paradox. There is an action which seems to be invariant under hyperbolic rotations, but the equations of motion are not, which is contrary to all Noether theorems and everything that one has been told about action. So what is the problem? Where is the paradox? And how is it that the action is indeed invariant? So this is what I just said. Yeah, so I'm just, well, you can read what I just said. So I will also clarify that. OK. Well, the point is that the action is not a function of f mu nu as a basic, it is written in terms of f mu nu, but the basic dynamical variables are not f mu nu, they are the vector potential. Now, when I have an action which is a function of some variables q, to check the invariance of the action, I have to tell you how q transforms and check the variation of the action under these variations of q. So I have to tell you how a mu, the vector potential, which are the dynamical variables in the action, transforms. So I have to tell, I have written the transformations in terms of f. What is the transformation in terms of mu, a mu? And these transformations, of course, you have to know them off shell, because to vary to check the invariance of the action, of course, you are not on shell. Any action is always invariant on shell, because on shell, its variation is proportional to the equations of motion, which are zero. So I have to define for you the variation of the vector potential of shell, corresponding to the duality transformation. But then you immediately encounter a problem that there is no variation of the vector potential that yields the above duality transformation of the field strength. And the proof is absolutely elementary. Well, when you introduce a mu, well, then of course, this is an identity. So these two, these Maxwell equations become an identity. Now, if I rotate f into f prime by making a duality transformation, so the new f prime will not fulfill df prime equal to zero identically. In other words, it cannot be written as dA prime, where A prime would be the transformed vector potential. So there is no transformed vector potential that will reproduce off shell the, of course, on shell, df star is equal to zero, and there is no problem, but I have to work off shell, as I said. So there is no transformation of the vector potential that will reproduce the given transformation of the vector field. And so it's meaningless to ask, it's not even to check that it's not invariant. It's meaningless to ask whether the Maxwell action is invariant under the above Dirac transformation of the field strength, because these variations of the field strength do not follow from a variation of the basic canon, the basic variables of the action principle. And in the same way, the corresponding computation with hyperbolic rotation is, I mean, the same argument applies, is also meaningless, and hence, at least we understand there is no contradiction between the apparent invariance of the action and the non-invariance of the equations of motion. Okay, but this is a negative result. Can we do something positive? And the answer is yes. Although the variation, there is no variation of the vector potential, that is the standard duality rotations of the field strengths of shell, one can find transformations of EMU that reproduce these duality rotations on shell. And furthermore, and well, this is the best we can do, as I just argued. I mean, on off shell, it's impossible to reproduce the transformations. Okay, now this is slightly more technical, and since my main point is to convey ideas, I will be a bit faster, because it's technical, it's in black. So, well, first of all, it's clear that the variation of the vector potential will not be unique. We can always add gauge transformation terms. I mean, the vector potential is defined up to a gauge transformation. And since we really want things to be to work on, to reproduce a given transformation on shell, we can also add terms proportional to the equations of motion in the transformation. Okay, so I will fix part of this ambiguity by, non-local terms will occur, but I will want the non-local terms to occur in a way which is controllable, which means that only inverse Laplacian, so it will not be covariant, manifestly covariant. But I don't want to have things non-local in time, because I think it's always dangerous to have things which are non-local in time. It's much more difficult to control, while things which are non-local in space with appropriate boundary conditions at spatial infinity you can control. So I will also use a gauge ambiguity to be such that under a duality transformation, the zeros component of the vector potential does not transform. And so here is the required duality transformation of the vector potential, I claim. So you see that it's non-local. I did that infinitesimally, but you can write by integrating the full, because it's an abelian symmetry, so it's easy to integrate the full gauge symmetry. So this is the transformation. Do I call that a duality transformation? Well, because indeed, if you compute the variation of the magnetic field, well, you will find some, well, I spare the detailed calculation here, but the important thing is that you will find that. So you will find that indeed it rotates, well, this is an infinitesimal rotation into the electric field, plus a term, but which is equal to zero when the Maxwell's equations are fulfilled, because this is zero. Okay, so indeed it does what it should do, at least for the magnetic field, but it also does what it should do on the electric field, because if you compute from this formula the variation of the electric field, which is just that, because A0 does not transform, well, again, after some transformation, you find that this is a term which is just as it should, proportional to the electric field. Then there is an extra term, which is again equal to zero on shell, because this is zero by the Maxwell's equation. So at least this equation, this transformation of the vector potential, reproduces the standard duality transformation of the electric and magnetic field. But more than that, it also leaves the Maxwell equation invariant. And let me just flash the formula. If you compute, so there was E squared minus B squared. The variation of the E squared term is a total derivative. You just crank the formulas. In the same way, the variation of the B squared term is a total derivative. And so the difference between the two, so the variation of the action, will just be a total derivative, and so the action is invariant under the duality rotation that I have written. In other words, duality is a genuine neuter symmetry. It's a symmetry of the action. It's an off-shell symmetry, which means that it has a neuter charge. You can compute the neuter charge, and which means also that it is expected to be a symmetry of the quantum theory unless there are anomalies. Because propagation amplitudes involve the action, so if you want things to be relevant in the quantum theory, it better be an off-shell symmetry rather than just a non-shell symmetry. Okay. Now, as I said, this thing, the formula I wrote, well, prove duality invariance of Maxwell's theory, of the action of Maxwell's theory, but they were non-local term, and the duality is not absolutely manifest. You can both get a local formulation and manifest duality invariance of the action by introducing a second vector potential, by going to the first order formulation, which is the Hamiltonian formulation. That's a formulation in terms of the initial vector potential A and its conjugate momentum, which is the electric field. But then the electric field is subject to some constraint, Gauss's constraint, which tells that its divergence is equal to zero. Now you can solve the constraints by introducing a second vector potential. So just as we have that for the magnetic field, well, you solve this because the magnetic field is divergence free. You can solve that equation by introducing another vector potential. And it turns out that if you write the Maxwell action in first order form, but the same action, but written in first order form, in terms of these two vector potentials, the action is local. Well, Maxwell's action was local too. So, but not only is it local, its duality invariance is manifest. So it takes A and B refers to these two vector potentials. So it's clearly that if you make rotations of the vector potentials, which amounts to duality rotations because B and E are related to these vector potentials in the same way, this action will be invariant. Well, that term is invariant because delta AB is invariant under SO2 rotations. But of course, epsilon AB is also invariant under SO2 rotation, so this action is manifestly duality invariant. This is what I just said. Well, actually, it's interesting that it's also invariant under gate transformations, but now, because you have two vector potentials, it's invariant under two different U1 gauge groups. So somehow you have enlarged the gauge symmetry to a U1 cross U1. And also, as I said, the transformation, the duality transformation is just rotation of the two vector potentials, which is local. So we have gained locality by introducing the second vector potential, which is what I just said. I should say that I mentioned in the case of supergravity, you have several abelian vector fields, and instead of having U1 duality, so SO2 duality, you have a UN duality invariant, which might even be enlarged when there are scalar fields to SP, it's 2N, it should be SP2N duality invariants. Well, you can show that, again, it's not just a symmetry of the equations of motion, it's a symmetry of the action. And of course, you will say, well, we have locality, we have manifest duality invariance, but we seem to be losing, we do lose manifest Poincaré invariance. Of course, the action is Poincaré invariant. I mean, it's the same action as the Maxwell's action that we have just rewritten. So Poincaré invariance is there, but is not manifest. And I will have to make, I will make some comment on that later. Well, not from the kinetic term, because the kinetic term is multiplied. Okay, it's true for the Hamiltonian. It's not true for the kinetic term. You will have to make an integration by parts to, because the magnet, yes, you will make an integration by parts. So you still have a surface term, which means that when you compute the neutral charge, you have to be careful. But I mean, Okay, now what about, something is loading, I don't know. What about duality of the Einstein equations? Well, this is actually what I want to, I started late, right? This will actually be the central topic of my talk. So it turns out that we have an analogous duality invariance of the Einstein equations, at least at the linearized level, and I will comment on the general case later. And how do we see that? Well, the Riemann tensor, and I've written it at the linearized level in terms of the Polyfield field, obeys a cyclic identity, that's well known, and on shell, so when the equations of motion hold, it also obeys, so these are the linearized, these are the Einstein equations. Linearized because I took the linearized Riemann tensor, okay? Now, these two things imply that if you look at the dual to the Riemann tensor, so I will define the dual to the Riemann tensor as usual, so I'm dualizing on two indices, will obey exactly the same two equations. Because in terms of the dual, this cyclic identity becomes the fact that the dual is traceless. Well, we know that trace and antisymmetrization are related, while the traceless condition on mu nu becomes is equivalent to that. So these equations are completely equivalent to these one. And so, so these ones imply that, and conversely, these ones imply that. And so we see that the dual and the Riemann tensor obey exactly the same equations, which means that the equations, the Einstein equations linearized, are invariant under rotations that mix the Riemann tensor, which I didn't write indices here, but this is the Riemann tensor, with its dual, just as we found for electromagnetism. Or in a 3 plus 1 fashion, well, for the Riemann tensor, we can define an electric piece and a magnetic piece. The electric piece would be the component with two zeros, a magnetic piece with one zero. Well, we can, I mean, these, when they're written in 3 plus 1 fashion, just like we did for electromagnetism, just rotate the electric component and the magnetic components of the Riemann tensor. Now, this is a symmetry of the equations of motion. Is it a symmetry of the action? Maybe to give maybe some intuition on that, you can show that this rotation, it's an SO2 group, in fact rotates the Schwarzschild mass into the Taubnert parameter n. Now you might say, but these are nonlinear results and we were talking about linear gravity, so what do you mean by that? Well, Schwarzschild at infinity, we have weak fields, so we can compute the Riemann tensor according to the weak field approximation at infinity. We can apply on it the duality transformation, and what you will find is the asymptotic form of the Riemann tensor of the Taubnert solution. So that's why people say that gravitational duality transforms Schwarzschild into Taubnert. Okay, so it's an interesting symmetry. And then the question is, we've seen it's a symmetry of the equations of motion. Is it also a symmetry of the action, of the Polyfield, of the linearized Einstein action? Now, of course, in this case, because the Riemann, this action does not involve the Riemann tensor, you cannot just rotate the Riemann tensor and conclude that it's not an invariance, as wrongly done in the Maxwell case. I mean, you have to face directly the question of how does H mu nu transform? So you have to tell the transformation rule of of H mu nu, and it turns out that if you do that properly, the answer is positive, just as in Maxwell's theory. And rather than go through the steps and write things covariantly but non-local in terms of H mu nu, I will go directly to the local formulation, which is the first order formulation, because that one is manifestly duality invariant. So I will go to the Hamiltonian formulation of the Polyfield theory. And just as we did in the Maxwell case where we solved the Gauss's law constraint, I will solve the constraints, and the hope is that the resulting action in terms of variables which are not constrained will be manifestly duality invariant. And this turns out to be the case. So now I have contrary to what happens in the Maxwell case, I have two types of constraints. I have the Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint. The momentum constraint is somehow analogous to Gauss's law. It's a constraint on the conjugate momentum to the metric, and solving it will introduce one potential, which I will call a pre-potential, because, well, for reasons that I will immediately explain. Now, the metric is subject to the Hamiltonian constraint. So we have also to solve that constraint, and that will introduce a potential for the metric, but because the metric, in a sense, is already a potential, we call these objects that we introduce pre-potentials. Okay? We call them pre because they are somehow potential for potentials. Okay, so for instance, just to give an example, the momentum constraint is this. The divergence of the momentum conjugate to the metric is equal to zero. And the way you solve that is by introducing an object which is symmetric of this, and this is contains two derivatives of it, and it's clear that this expression solves that, because I take di, because it's antisymmetric in ip, and di dp, that will be zero. But you can show also that this is a general solution to that constraint. In the same way, I didn't write it, the Hamiltonian constraint, which is purely at the linearized level on a constraint on the metric, on hij, the Polyfield field, can be solved, and that will introduce a second prepotential, which is also a symmetric tensor. But I put a 2 here because there are two of them, and that's a second one. Now, both potentials are symmetric tensors, so I emphasize it because in higher dimensions, they will be of different Young symmetry type. And it turns out, well, there is some redundancy. If I give you pij, pi ij, there will be many z's that will give the same pi ij. So there will be some gauge invariance on the z's. And also, pi ij itself is not a gauge invariant object. Pi ij will transform. Well, pi ij is related to the extrinsic curvature. So if you deform the slice, the extrinsic curvature changes. So there is some gauge invariance. I mean, it's not a gauge invariant content, so it does transform into a gauge symmetry. And you can show that the combined redundancy or a gauge invariance of Z1 is precisely of this form, a linearized diffeomorphism plus a linearized veil rescaling. This will account for the gauge symmetries in pi j. And remarkably enough, the metric has also some gauge invariances, and there is a redundancy in the description of the metric in terms of prepotential, and the corresponding prepotential has exactly the same gauge symmetry. So these are the linearized gauge symmetries of conformal gravity, linearized diffeomorphism, linearized veil rescalings. Okay. Now, in terms of prepotentials, the action reads, well, maybe I will let me show everything to comment. So the action takes a rather compact form. So there is a kinetic term, which involves the time derivative of the prepotential, and there is a Hamiltonian. Now, the coefficient here is, if I give you z is invariant at the linearized diffeomorphism. So a natural object to consider is the corresponding Riemann tensor, because that will be invariant under linearized diffeomorphism. But we had also this linearized veil rescaling, so that will not be invariant under linearized veil rescaling. The veil tensor is, but we are here in 3+1 dimensions, so in three dimensions, three spatial dimensions, the veil tensor is identically zero. To have a gauge conformal invariant quantity, you need to go to take one more derivative to build a Cotton tensor. And and what I call the co-Cotton tensor, well, you dualize a pair of indices to get. The Cotton tensor has three indices, is antisymmetric in two, so you can dualize and you get something which is that tensor here, which has three derivatives, which is symmetric, divergence free and traceless. And so this is what I mean by that. And the Hamiltonian is expressed in terms of the Ricci tensors constructed out of the prepotentials. Now you can show that this is also veil invariant, not just diffeomorphism invariant, and this is very easily checked to be, because of the properties of the co-Cotton tensor, to be invariant under diffeomorphism and linearized veil transformation. So, and also, you can see that the two the two Z's play exactly the same role in this action. So duality invariance is manifest. But again, we lose manifest space-time covariance. I mean, after the polyphase theory is Lorentz invariant, we don't see it immediately here. I will again say more about this later. So, but again, we see this tension between manifest duality invariance and manifest space-time covariance. Okay. So for gravity, and I should say also that this, so it's invariant under the rotation of the two pre-potentials, and these rotations will reproduce exactly the rotations of the Riemann tensor and its dual. So it's exactly like in electromagnetism. Now, what about higher dimensions? In higher dimensions, the curvature and its dual are tensors of different types, so you cannot rotate one into the other, but nevertheless, there is something that survives of duality, which is a so-called twisted self-duality reformulation of the theory. And I think the first to do that were Kramer and Julia in their very old paper of 1978. And let me look first at the P-form case. Not just electromagnetism, I consider P-forms. Okay. Now, what is the so-called twisted self-duality formulation of the equations of motion? So the standard formulation, and I'm considering three P-forms, I have a P-form here, is just the Maxwell action for the P-form. It gives equations of motion that tells me that the F dual is equal to zero. And of course, in addition to that, I have df is equal to zero because of the definition here. And the general solution to that equation is, of course, F dual is equal to db for some d minus p minus 2 form b, and which might be of different rank. So we are not like in for electromagnetism in four dimensions where both A and B were one forms. Here, these are forms of two different ranks. And this is precisely the problem I want to understand better. Now, and the idea about the twisted self-duality formulation is the following. Suppose that conversely, I have a P form A and a D minus P minus 2 form B. I form the curvatures, well, for A, I call the curvature B, F, sorry, for B, I call the curvature H. And suppose that they are dual to one another, to each other. So F is dual to H, and H is dual to F, of course, because star squared is not necessarily plus one. I need to put some factor here, which depends on the rank of the P form and the space-time dimension. But suppose that I set this, well, then it's clear that A will fulfill the Maxwell equations, because DF dual will be equal to zero, thanks to that, since dH is equal to zero, because H is dB. In other words, I can, so these equations are completely equivalent to the Maxwell's equations. In metric forms, I can rewrite these equations as follows. So I put the two curvatures together to form a column. And I'm saying that this object is dual to itself, well, up to a twist, a twisting matrix, which is given by that matrix, which I just read off from here. So these equations, which are completely equivalent to the Maxwell's equations, are called the twisted self-duality equations for the P-form. And they are nice because they somehow express some self-duality up to a twist. Okay, they are also nice because they put A and B on exactly the same footing. You see, the original formulation, starting from the Maxwell's action, had only A as basic variable. But we would like, 10 minutes, okay. We would like A and B to play the same role. And that can be done. Actually, my claim is that one can formulate the dynamics at the level of the action in such a way that A and B are on an equal footing. And as I said, when we study these hidden symmetries, E10, E11, all forms always appear with a dual and on the same footing. So if we want to have an action principle that exhibits manifestly these invariants, we'd better have an action principle that, in that simple case, put A and B on an equal footing. Okay, so again, and since we have gained experience with the previous D equal to 4 case, I will tell you how this can be done. One can construct an action which puts the two potentials on the same footing, and it will have the same features that it lacks manifest space-time covariance, but also being, of course, covariant. I mean, it's the original action just rewritten in first of order form. Actually, you don't have to remember the formula, but you see, I just went to the Hamiltonian formalism from the original actions that contained A, and then I solved the Gauss constraint for the momentum conjugate to A by introducing another vector potential, which turns out to be exact to be B, or the spatial components of B. But then A and B appears, and they appear on an equal footing. For instance, the Hamiltonian will contain both the magnetic energy of A and the magnetic energy of B. And so, and the kinetic term also can, written as it is here, it does not look completely symmetric, but you can, by integrating by part, make it write it in a more symmetric form. Okay, and you can show indeed that the equations of motions that follows from that action, which is really the original action, will express that the electric field of A is a magnetic field of B, and vice versa, the magnetic field of A is the electric field of B. And you see also that A and B are not only duality conjugate, but they will be also canonically conjugate. And yes, so I should say that what you call electric energy in one picture is a is a magnetic energy in the other picture. Okay, but so the important thing about this action, it's not well, I flashed it a little bit quickly, but it's really the Hamiltonian action, but instead of pi conjugate to A, I have solved the pi constraint to introduce a second vector potential, and what I have gained is an action in which both A and B are on an equal footing. Let's see, I might have skipped them. No. Now, you can include, actually, in this case, p-form interactions of the type of Chern-Simons interactions or modification of the curvature by Chern-Simons-like looking term. And the procedure is always the same. Write the action in Hamiltonian form, solve the constraint, and that introduces the dual vector potential, and then you get an action where the two are on the same footing. So this is a duality symmetric formulation of the theory. Now, space-time covariance is present for sure because we started from a covariant action, but it's not manifest. But it can be controlled by using, and this is something that goes back to the early 60s, to Dirac and Schwinger. They show that a necessary condition for a theory to be relativistic could be expressed in terms of the commutation relation of the energy momentum component, so the energy density and the momentum density, as to obey some commutation relations. When they are obeyed, the theory is relativistic. And in this picture, this is the best way to control relativistic invariance. And that can be, of course, done. Now that we can do the same for gravity, and my time is, I have 5 minutes, a little bit more, maybe, because I started late, but I'm not going to bargain too much. We have all the ideas. The new thing with gravity is that we are going to deal with tensors which are not so familiar. And let's do the simplest case, d equal 5. The dual graviton, as we will see, in this case is described by a tensor with this Young mixed symmetry type. So this means that it is antisymmetric in these two indices, and when you try to antisymmetrize in the three, you get zero. So I'm using conventions in which antisymmetries are manifest. Now, a theory of a massless tensor of this type was constructed in the 80s by Cartwright, who wrote the action and the gauge invariances. The gauge invariances are as follows. Well, actually, it has two gauge invariances which are independent, one which is described by a symmetric tensor, one which is described by an antisymmetric tensor, so one described by something which has this Young symmetry, so you remove the box below, and one which is described by this symmetry, you remove that box. So this one is alpha, and this one is sigma. So these are the gauge symmetries. Cartwright wrote an action, and, well, actually wrote the gauge invariant object, so you can write a gauge invariant curvature, which again will contain two derivatives of this T tensor, just like the Riemann tensor out of H. It has this Young symmetry type. There are two more indices. It obeys the analog of the Bianchi identities. Okay, that follows from the definition, and that when you anti-symmetrize two derivatives, you get zero. So these are rather easy to establish. And you can show conversely that if I give you a tensor with this Young symmetry type, which obeys these Bianchi identities, then it can be written in this way in terms of a tensor T. And, well, the equations are just the analog, the equations of motion that Courtright proposed, which are clearly gauge invariant, are just that the Ricci tensor obtained by taking a contraction on two indices here is equal to zero. Okay. Now, let me rewrite the Einstein equations in terms of S twisty step duality conditions. Well, starting from the Riemann tensor, I can construct this dual, but because I'm in five dimensions, there is one more index, and so the dual is something like that, of this Young symmetry type. Okay. Now, this tensor will obey the differential identities here because, and we'll have exactly the same identity, which will guarantee that we can write it as from a T, as a curvature of a tensor T. And it will be traceless because the cyclic identity was fulfilled by the R tensor. Let's see, why did I? Okay, never mind. So yeah, the reason why you can, this is that the equations of motion for one becomes the cyclic identity for the other, and the cyclic identity for one becomes the equation of motion for the other. Okay, now conversely, you can write the Einstein equations linearized as twisty self-duality condition as follows. Let's assume that we have two such tensors, H mu nu and T mu nu, such that R is a dual to A, to E. So which I can write in this way. I have dropped indices, which I can write as twisted self-duality conditions, but now on these curvatures. Well, I claim that these equations are completely equivalent to the linearized Einstein equations because the cyclic identity for one is, as I just said, is the trace condition for the others and vice versa. Okay. And so we see that indeed, again, just as for P forms, we can write the Einstein equations linearized as a twisted self-duality condition on the curvature of two objects, H mu nu and T alpha beta mu, the Courtright field. This formulation is interesting because it puts the graviton, the polyfierce field, on the same footing and it's due as its dual. And well, you can define the electric and magnetic components for these fields, and you can show that the twisted self-duality conditions just say that the magnetic field of one is the electric field of the other and vice versa. And so again, the question is, can we write this derive that from a variational principle where H and T are on the same footing? The original polyfierce variational principle does not fulfill that condition because you see only H, but the idea is that you do exactly the same to go to the correct variational principle that will put them both on the same footing. It's more involved, so I'm just flashing the general idea. You go to the first order formulation, you write the action in Hamiltonian form, you solve the constraints, that will introduce pre-potentials, one for the metric, one for the conjugate momentum to the metric. Because we are in a different dimension, these pre-potentials now have different Young symmetry type. Well, whatever, you just solve the constraints and this is what you get. And then you insert that back into the action, and you will get an action in which both these prepotentials are on an equal footing. But that means that, and actually you could have started from the Courtright action, you will end up with the same action. But now, that means that you have a formulation which is completely duality symmetric in the sense that both Hij and Tijk are on the same footing, because these prepotential plays two roles. It's the prepotential for Hij, but at the same time, the prepotential that you need to solve the momentum constraint in the Courtright, on the Courtright side. And this one is a prepotential for the momentum conjugate to the metric, but at the same time is a prepotential for the Kurtwright field. So you see that both fields are exactly on the same footing as soon as you solve the constraints and go to that form of the action. You can show that the equations of motion imply that the electric energy of one is just the magnetic energy of the other field, of the dual field, so exactly like P forms. And that brings me to the conclusion. So I think I'm more or less on time, so I need one more minute. So electric magnetic gravitational duality is, well, I didn't have the time to show how remarkable it is, but I believe it is a remarkable symmetry. It is an off-shell symmetry, not just an on-shell symmetry. And I think that's quite important because that implies the existence of a conserved neutral charge. That implies the fact that you can expect, unless there are anomalies, that the symmetry is present as a quantum level and so can control amplitudes and can control possible counterterms, for instance. As I said, we seem to pay a price that when we want to have a manifestly duality symmetric formulation, we lose manifest Poincaré invariance. And, well, we have tried. That seems to be something which is, well, there are two ways. Well, there are two things that I should say here. One is that actually people have successfully constructed formulations which are both manifestly duality invariant and Poincaré invariant. But the price to pay is to introduce many more fields, but more importantly, to lose, if the action is free, a quadratic action. So we'll get a non-polynomial action, and then, I mean, square root and 1 over square root. So I think that if you want to keep a simple formulation, as I said, there is a tension between manifest duality invariance and Poincaré invariance. Now, you might say, well, that is it. Or you might say, well, maybe there is a lesson that should be drawn from that. And you can at least entertain the idea that maybe the lesson to be drawn from that is that duality invariance might be more fundamental than space-time covariance. Well, after all, space-time, these are more words at this stage, might be a derived concept, but we might hope that in a fundamental formulation of the theory, symmetry and duality symmetry would be present and an important symmetry, while Poincaré invariance might be a derived invariance. And in fact, we can construct a model in which we don't assume Poincaré invariance, we force duality, and we show that the Schwinger-Dirac relations are automatically fulfilled, which means that Poincaré invariance is fulfilled. I'm now really rushing the rest. I think these are important for the E10 conjectures because E10 has duality symmetry built in, and this shows that it's legitimate to search for actions which are inter-invariant because not just the equations of motion will be E10 invariant or 11 invariant, but the action itself should be. And there are many open questions to be understood. To introduce couplings, we can do it for P forms, except for the minimal coupling. We cannot do it for gravity, but there are positive indications that this could be done. After all, this Taubnut solution is a solution of the full theory. Schwarzschild is a solution of the full theory, and we have seen that they are somehow duals. Dimensional reduction also gives indications of these structures, so I will not say more. There is much more work to be done, as I said. I can answer questions. I would just thank you now to stop more or less in time.
Mark?
So you mentioned this being useful in the context of maximal supergravity in these big algebras like E10. So just to kind of clarify on your last point, you think this type of construction will carry over when you've got supersymmetry? So you just demonstrated it for regular gravity, but you think,
yeah, I think
the same kind of things work when you've got supersymmetry?
Yeah, so you can include fermions. I didn't discuss fermions. The fermions will transform under the so-called maximal compact, and I put that in quotation marks, of E10. So you can indeed include the gravitino, and you can show that it's compatible with the E10 symmetry. I mean, that the equations of motion, or at least at the lower, at the same order as we have been able to check E10, that the equations of motion will be compatible with E10. I should add, however, and this is extremely puzzling, the fact that to a large extent, results that one derives traditionally using supersymmetry can be equivalently derived using E10 symmetry. For instance, the Chern-Simons term.
Do you lose manifest supersymmetry in the same way that you lost manifest Poincaré invariance?
Oh, manifest supersymmetry. You will have to handle supersymmetry in a more, I mean, again, there will be the analog of the Dirac-Schwinger commutation relations. But what I want to say is that maybe there will be, and that actually is an indication that duality might be more fundamental than these space-time symmetries, that many of the results that people traditionally derive using supersymmetry, like, for instance, in 11-dimensional supergravity, we know that we need a Chern-Simons term. The coefficient of this Chern-Simons term is fixed by invariance under supersymmetry. If you start from E10 and you use group theoretical argument, and in particular the Campbell-Hausdorff formula to develop things, you will find from the development of the most direct E10 invariant Lagrangian automatically appear the Chern-Simons coefficient in the action with the same coefficient as the one that is needed for supersymmetry. So without appealing to supersymmetry, you will get exactly the Chern-Simons coefficient, written in a non-covariant way, but the same Chern-Simons coefficient. In the same way, you can show that E10 covariant derivatives, or I should say covariant derivatives with respect to the maximal compact subgroup, which are the one relevant for fermions, will contain a piece which is a standard spin connection covariant derivative, but then it will contain a piece which contains a field strength of the three form with some coefficient, and both E10 and supersymmetry predict the same covariant derivative. So I think that there is this only strengthens the idea that there is something fundamental, perhaps more fundamental, in these duality symmetries than in space-time symmetries. But no one understands that. This has been experimentally, if I can say, observed.
So I have two questions. One is, in the simple cases like ENM or GR or linearized GR in 4D, what is the global charge associated with this symmetry?
Yeah, the global charge will be given by an integral which looks like, it will be an integral over three space of something that looks like, it has been written in the literature, like a Chern-Simons term involving the two potentials.
I see, and there's no obvious expression involving just EMB, for instance, you're saying.
No, because like the Chern-Simons term, I mean, there is one potential. I mean,
yes.
One of the two can be written in terms of the field, but not the other one.
Okay, the second question I have is, does this symmetry commute with Lorentz, with Poincaré in general?
Yes.
It commutes. Thank you.
All right. Let's thank the speaker again.